SF Signal episode 32, interview with Peter V. Brett. This is the SF Signal podcast as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And today we bring you an interview with author Peter V. Brett. Peter is the author of The Warded Man and its sequel, The Desert Spear, along with some other great stuff. And you need to check out his website to see all that. And we had the opportunity, John Ottinger and myself, to sit down with Peter a couple weeks ago and do this interview. So without further ado, let's just go right into it with Peter V. Brett, John Ottinger, and myself.
Thanks, Patrick. Really appreciate it. Thank you, Peter, for being on.
You're welcome. Happy to do it.
Great. For those who don't know, Peter Brett is the, best known as Pete, is the best-selling author of the epic fantasy The Warded Man, known as The Painted Man in the UK, and its sequel, The Desert Spear, as well as The Great Bazaar, a collection of stories, and the upcoming Brian's Gold, a novella set in the Demon Cycle world. And he's currently at work on The Daylight War, the third novel in his proposed five-part Demon Cycle. So Pete, something that's been bothering me a lot is what on earth is with the V in your middle, as your middle initial? What does it stand for and why do you use it?
Well, I mean, I use it cause it's my name. It stands for Vincent. That's my middle name. And, I've been using that in my signature for as long as I've been signing things. Technically, my middle name is Vincent Dalton, but that would be Peter V.D. Brett, and I didn't want V.D. in my name. So I dropped that kind of early.
Good call.
I know a guy named Van Dongen.
That's not much better.
No, it's not.
So when I sold my novel, and I was looking for websites. I found out that I couldn't get peterbrett.com because this like architect in the UK had also named Peter Brett had like was sitting on the URL. He wasn't even using it. He just had it.
I hate that. I've run into that more than once.
Yeah. And then I also found out that there's a Peter Brett who writes like carpentry books and had written like a ton of books and was actually a really popular writer. So I wanted to use the V anyway, and that just kind of like spurred me on. Well, it's okay if I make it like a part of my official author name, then I can have that be the website. I can, you know, like it'll be a distinctive signature. If you Google me, it'll be easier to find me. You know, like it was a somewhat calculated decision, but at the end of the day, it's my name.
All right.
That's, I don't know.
All right.
I didn't mean that rancy. It just kind of like.
Say it again.
I didn't mean to sound that sound like a rant, but I guess it kind of was. It's been building up for years, waiting for somebody to ask me about it.
Yeah, I always find that an interesting question. So I was interested. You're now you're a father now. I guess your daughter's what, 3-4 years old now?
She's not quite 3. She's about 2.5. She just started talking like over Christmas, so like she's become a whole different person all of a sudden. Like. You know, she went from being like a very inactive part of the room to like now just dominating everything because she's talking up a storm and like holds everyone's attention as soon as she opens her mouth.
What was her first word? Arlen?
No, I tried to read her the book once and I have a picture of her like screaming and crying about it. I haven't tried since.
That's funny. Well, that kind of leads me into some of my other questions for you. I was watching your Romantic Times interview that you just posted. I think it was yesterday. Romantic Times Book Reviews. I guess they go by RT Book Reviews. Is that right?
Yeah, they're branching out to cover a lot more than romance since they're doing science fiction and fantasy and other things. So they, they're kind of rebranding themselves as just RT. Although Romantic Times, the name holds a little more cachet, I guess, still, because it was very popular. It's very popular.
Sure. And that's actually kind of the idea. You were talking on there a little bit about branding and what you did for branding yourself with having Lauren Cannon design wards for you. And to go along with the books, and then how you had passed those along to your publishers. You know, you paid for them, and then you had your you passed them on to the publisher and said, here, if you want to use them, use them. And then almost every publisher you've had worldwide has then used them. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I think I have a PR background. I used to do medical publishing and PR I did that for about 10 years before becoming a published writer and leaving that job for this one. And so because of that, like, I got to wear a lot of hats in publishing and do a lot of online marketing. And, you know, I ran podcasts for doctors and hired artists and things like that. So I had a lot of those kind of PR skills when I moved into publishing. And I had a very real idea of how I wanted to present myself and how I wanted to present my books. And that was something that I'd been kind of thinking about for years, long before I ever actually sold them. So, you know, I kind of came at it with a plan. And part of that plan was I'm going to have artwork that I commissioned that I think really represents what I'm doing, and I'll base my website around that was my original plan. But then I also just offered that artwork to the publisher since I'd already paid for it and owned the rights to it. And because of that, I was kind of able to like very early on, like put a stamp on some of the design work for the series. And I think that has really paid off in the long run, because it publishers are reluctant to work together with their counterparts in other countries. So really, if the author doesn't provide that kind of unification or the author's agent, it often doesn't happen. But because I was right there at the core of every sale saying, hey, here's this free art, you can use it if you want to, like it's become like worldwide, they use those same symbols, which I think is fantastic.
So you talked about branding and you did it yourself. The question is, do you recommend that for other authors, and is it like cost prohibitive, or, you know, how would you go about doing that kind of thing if you were an author wanting to brand yourself in that way?
I absolutely think that authors should do that. Any new author who's just coming into the business, absolutely positive, unless their publisher has a really good marketing team that's looking to work with them to help them do this stuff. And to be frank, most publishers don't. The author really needs to take that on themselves. And it's difficult because a lot of times authors are introverted people who spend all of their time in front of a computer. I know I'm one of them. And because of that, when you have to present a public face, like it can be difficult. And so you want to do it in a controlled way that says what you want it to say, and you want to present your work in the same fashion. The thing is that it's a skill set to set that sort of thing up, and so some authors might be able to handle that aspect of things, and some authors might need a little help with it. But I think that if you do it carefully and you make careful decisions, it's not prohibitively expensive. There is a certain amount of outlay to hire an artist or to build your website or to do whatever. But if you do it right and you do a good job, I think that the returns are worth it, or at least they have been for me. And I've helped a few other authors set up similar things. And I think it's been really good for them as well.
Can I interject something here?
Sure.
I hate author websites.
Okay.
Because the majority of them look like they were built for GeoCities. They have the scrolling thing across the top. It's all one big long page. There's funky looking graph. I mean, your site is gorgeous. But
thank you.
For the most part, I mean, author websites are terrible. And I don't know who is selling them to them, but I want to kick their butt.
Well, I mean, again, like this is what I'm saying. Like, I have a minor in art history. Like, I had aspirations to be an artist once. And I think that I have like I've read a million comic books and filled sketchbooks and things. So like I have like a layman's art background, I guess. That combined with the fact that I was a production manager and art director professionally in PR, I think helped me build these things. Like I had a very clear design in my head of what I wanted my website to look like. When I commissioned Lauren to do the wards and to do the paintings, like I would give her pages of notes of like, here's what I want you to do. And, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about exactly how the ward should look and, you know, whether there should be some unifying factor in every ward, which there is. Not every author is creative in that way. And that's okay because there are some authors that have lousy websites, but they're, you know, wonderful on Twitter or they're wonderful in person or they're, you know, like every, like, you don't, everyone doesn't have to do the same thing. But I think a lot of the older authors just had trouble adapting, but I was web savvy enough to put something together that was presentable.
Yes, you were.
and it really is. It really does come off very nicely. It's very easy to navigate, which is one of the key factors, I think.
Well, that's the thing. It's like you want to make something pretty, but you also want to keep it simple. Like the more buttons and bells and whistles you put on there, the more things get lost. So like that's why I have like the home page is just like one painting that I commissioned that I think is really beautiful, and then like a couple of little you know, like a link to the blog, a link to the other thing along the top. So it's a nice, neat, clean presentation, much like the Google website, you know? Like, that's what you want. You want something that you can go to. It's simple. You know how to get around. You don't have to search around on it too much. The more complicated you make your website, the more difficult it is for everybody.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of your website, you actually maintain a forum, run a blog, do the whole gamut of things, and spend a lot of time interacting with your fans. Why do you devote so much writing time to your fans?
Because they're awesome. because not 3 years ago, well, maybe 3 years ago, I was running around saying, somebody, anybody, please, 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 please read my book. Like, you know, to publishers and to agents, you know, like nobody had read any of my books. And so just getting an agent was this huge, you know, amazing, gratifying thing. And then getting the book sale was this huge, amazing, gratifying thing. But none of that compares to like the people who actually go into a store and buy your book or go online and buy your book and read it and think about it and want to interact with you because of it. I find that's such a huge honor, and it makes me want to be friends with all of them, and I regret that I don't have time to, you know. So I try and interact as much as I can with people because I really like, you know, gosh darn it, I sure appreciate them buying the book and the fact that they enjoy something that like was this huge creative thing for me is a thrill.
Well, and one thing that your interaction with the fans has really done is spawned a lot, plus the contests you've run for, like, advanced reader editions and things, have really spawned all this artwork related to the books themselves. And I was kind of wondering, has the artwork that you've seen that fans have created in any way affected maybe the way that you describe characters or setting at any point?
Well, I mean, the contests have generated amazing stuff, like far more than I ever would have imagined. You know, when I first did the fan art contest, I was kind of feeling like nobody was going to submit anything. And then, you know, we got this deluge of incredible artwork. And every contest I've done, like I've tried to keep it simple, like do something creative, you know, write a haiku or whatever the theme of the contest is, like do something creative. And I make it something that like you could do very quickly and easily without devoting too much of your time. But there's also leeway to be as creative and take as much time as you want. And there have been a lot of people who've invested hours of their lives and made beautiful, beautiful things. That is wonderful and a huge honor. And I always feel like I need more prizes because like I don't have enough to give to everybody that deserves one. But I don't think that the art really influences how I see the characters in my head or how I describe them in the books. In the same way that like I've read Spider-Man for 30 years now through many, many different artists. And like the artist doesn't influence who Spider-Man is to me, you know, like I'm kind of, I can appreciate the different styles and the different ways of presenting something, but none of them really changes the core character that's in my head. And it's the same thing with the books. It is interesting when I see people creating artwork based on artwork that I've, like the artwork that I originally commissioned, you know, like for a few of the core characters, I called Lauren and we made a portrait of Arlen, a portrait of Rena, like the wards. And those were all made to exact specifications of like, here's how I want this to look. So when I see fan art come back that's based off those things, that has like original wards, but they're in the same vein as the ones we designed, or like has or pictures of Rena that are clearly derivative from the painting that's on my homepage, like those things give a huge thrill to me because you see how people can take, you know, a basis that you've presented and still be very creative in their own way with it and do something new, but also have it like you can see the root of it. And I love that. Like the evolution of art just fascinates me.
So you brought up a very good question that I have for you now.
Mm-hmm.
Felicia Hardy, Mary Jane Watson, or Gwen Stacy?
Felicia Hardy is going to be in the new Spider-Man movie?
They've talked about her being in it.
Oh, wait.
But that's not what I'm asking you.
I'm sorry.
Felicia Hardy, Gwen Stacy.
I had Felicia Day on the brain, so I thought that you were telling me that Felicia Day was in the...
No.
All right, none of that makes sense. I got it. So you're saying which girlfriend should Spider-Man have in the Spider-Man movie? Felicia Hardy. God damn. Black Cat.
It's about time for Black Cat.
It's time for a Black Cat big screen appearance.
Yes.
It's time.
I agree.
I'm tired of Mary Jane. Mary Jane was only Spider-Man's... like Spider-Man got along for years without Mary Jane, many, many years before Mary Jane became a big issue. And she just came in and took over. And my core Spider-Man days were Spider-Man was dating the Black Cat back in the 80s with the black mm-hmm. costume. Mm-hmm. Like that was my kid's fight. That's where Spider-Man is locked for me.
You remember when Doctor Strange took the hex off him and Felicia ended up getting the crap kicked out of her?
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah, that was like there was some hardcore shit in there. Like that was good. And this need to put Spider-Man in a committed relationship as part of the Spider-Man narrative kind of bugs me because like the best Spider-Man times are like, oh, you know, like I missed my date because I had to go be Spider-Man and now she's mad at me and like, you know, then I got to make my rent and when he's having these real life problems that people have. He's much more interesting than when he's married. You know?
Aren't we all?
Well, this is my point. So, like, why do they keep rushing to put him with Mary Jane? Like, you let him date for a while. He's young.
Infinitely.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we've digressed. If you get me talking about comic books, we'll be here all night.
The only time I interject into these interviews recently is when I just want to really... you know, throw off someone like John Ottinger.
You always do.
Throw him off his game. Go for it, John. What's your next question?
Well, actually, the next question is comic book related because now you're working on that Red Sonja.
Yes.
And how's that going? And, you know, since you're a huge comic book fan, you know, how nervous were you and all that business? So.
I am a huge comic book fan and I was a huge Red Sonja fan. And so when I got the chance to write Red Sonja, I was really, really, really excited to do it. But also extremely nervous because I'm a huge control freak. And this would be me stepping into a new medium. I think that a lot of writers tend to get a little arrogant and say, well, I'm a writer, and so I could write a script, or I could write a comedy, or I could write this, or I could write that. But the fact of the matter is that, like, writing a comic book script is a different skill set from writing a novel or writing a short story or writing a blog post or whatever. And when I tried to do it, it ended up being a lot harder than I thought it was going to be, and made me maybe a little more forgiving towards many comic book writers that I've cursed over the years. just because, like, I'm used to telling a story, like, pretty much entirely through prose now. And so describing the action for the artist, in addition to the prose or in place of the prose, and doing it in a way that breaks down. So it's like, so you say, like, okay, I have a big event that's going to happen on page 3. That's going to take up the whole page. So I have to make sure that everything before that fits onto page 2, but I have too much for, I have like a page and a half worth of stuff. So how do I like moving that stuff around like a jigsaw puzzle, was something that was a lot harder than I anticipated. So it took me a really long time to get this first script done. But I learned a lot in that period. And, now that I turned in the script a couple of weeks ago, for the first book, which is just going to be a one shot. It's going to be like a 32 page, one shot story. I turned in the script and I just heard back from them this morning. They had like a couple of minor changes. So I'm going to do a last pass of that, give it back to them on Monday. And, they're going to send that out to the artist who, I hear is going to be Mel Ruby, who's, fantastic and has done a lot of work on Red Sonja.
Well, it must be difficult going from, you know, a 580-page novel to a 32-page comic book where, you know, you've only got so much space for text and you want more space for imagery and panels and all that business. So, you know, was that really difficult to keep yourself back from doing too much text?
Yeah, it was hard. As a comic book reader, I know how annoying it gets when the writer overdoes it and starts writing in a ton of text that you don't need. Like, I do believe in the kind of minimalist approach of the art should carry as much as possible, and then the text should just complement the art and shouldn't overpower it. So, you know, you're moving a lot of that storytelling into the image. And some writers, I think, are very lax about that and kind of let the artist worry about it. Whereas I try to be specific in the panels of, like, this is what I want going on here, and here's how you should lay this out. But I had originally planned a much longer story that was going to take about 4 issues. And when we decided to do a one shot and I had to consolidate all of that story into 30 pages, that was very difficult and required some heavy cutting. But I think I have a really, really, like, funny take on the character that's going to be unique. Because, again, it's going to play back to my 80s comic book strength, where, like, Red Sonja in the 80s was a very different creature from the Red Sonja that's around now. She had this, like, ridiculous blue fur bathing suit that she wore. Like, it was sort of like the Conan shorts. But it was blue and fur. And it was just,
that, you know, I need to interject. Wait, hold on. I need to interject here.
Yeah.
The reason that it was blue fur is because she killed a Muppet. killed it, skinned it, wore it.
That would make sense. Maybe it's Grover.
It was the 80s. The Muppets were over. But the thing
is, it's like she started out in this tiny little chainmail bikini, and then, that book got canceled in the 70s. And then in the 80s, they put her in this, like, blue fur bathing suit, like one piece bathing suit that was just as, like, impractical and revealing as the chainmail bikini, but it was, like, slightly less over the top sexist, I guess. And they had women writing and drawing the comic book. And so there was this brief run for about, I don't know, 13 issues or so before it got canceled, right around the time they made that Brigitte Nielsen movie.
That's what I was going to say. That kind of ruined it.
Yeah, it was a terrible movie. So then the book got canceled, and it stayed in limbo forever until Dynamite brought it back and brought the character back to, like, the core chainmail bikini that was very iconic, and kind of resurrected Red Sonja from the dead. And I was really thrilled about that, because I I love those comics in the 80s so much. So my one-shot take for this book is to have, like, you know, an unfortunate happenstance occur to the chainmail bikini, forcing Red Sonja to wear, like, a blue fur one-piece bathing suit for an issue. It's like an homage to the 80s book. And it's just full of, like, jokes about how impractical the chainmail bikini is, which is like the elephant in the room that no one ever talks about on that book. So I think it's going to be good. It's going to have plenty of action and adventure, but it's also going to be kind of funny. So
is there any tie in to the Robert Rodriguez project?
No, there is not.
Okay. Just curious. Cause I mean, there is another movie that could ruin it again.
Or it could be awesome, because Robert Rodriguez has, like, he's done some awesome movies.
Yeah.
And it was going to star, what's her head?
Marilyn Manson's old girlfriend.
Right. Wasn't she on Charmed as well?
I don't know.
I can't remember.
Something with a G. Was it a G? Gwen. Maybe I'm stuck now.
All right, now we're just going to flounder. We're going to flounder, and this is being recorded. So let's skip it. But yeah, it could be a very good movie.
Rose McGowan.
Yes, right. Rose McGowan, yes. who's gorgeous and awesome. And I think a Rose McGowan, Robert Rodriguez, Red Sonja movie could be really awesome. Like, it could also be Catwoman, but you never know. but this doesn't have anything to do with that. I think they're doing a separate line of comics that will be direct movie tie-ins. That's not what I want to do. I wanted to do something that was my own.
Gotcha.
Cool. So how do you, I mean, you talked about how you have some fight scenes, action scenes in the Red Sonja. And then of course there are plenty in your novels. How do you tend to visualize those scenes as you're writing, or, you know, some authors like to use action figures. I know some have gone to the experts and asked questions and things like that. How do you go about putting those things together?
It's the one thing that's always come easily to me in writing. Almost everything else is grueling and miserable. But writing fight scenes, I can usually write them in about the time it takes to read them. Part of that, I think, is because I grew up reading those R.A. Salvatore Forgotten Realms books, Stewart and Dark Elf books.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, those are just, like, packed with constant detailed descriptions of fight scenes. I just love that stuff. I love watching kung fu movies and other martial arts movies. When I was in college, we did sword fighting. We'd take, like, those bamboo kendo swords, shinai, me and a couple of friends of mine, and we'd beat the crap out of each other. And I took kendo lessons for a while. So I've had to interject there.
Did you win or lose those fights?
Win some, lose some. I got pretty good. I was pretty good at it. It's one of those things that, like, I had to grow up and get a job and couldn't really just go around hitting people with swords anymore. But I used to love sword fighting, and I really miss it.
Who's backing up?
Hmm. Oh, sorry. That's my window. This is New York. I've been in enough fights one way or another and read about enough fights that it's usually, if I know who wins, I can just rattle off an exciting fight scene. Sometimes when I'm taking notes about a book, like, I'll already start thinking of cool moves and, like, oh, you know, I'll leap over this and do this and leave those in my notes for when I get around to writing that scene.
Go ahead, Patrick.
No, I was just going to interject that Rose McGowan has apparently left the Red Sonja project.
Does the project still exist?
I don't know. But I did Google it just now, and she has apparently left. And there's a horrible, 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 horrible headline that says, Rose McGowan out, Megan Fox in.
Oh, that's scary.
Well, Megan Fox is very pretty.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
That's, you know, can say that for her.
I can see it now. You know, she'll be interviewed and they'll say, you know, what's going to be your inspiration for the character? Well, I'm gonna, you know, channel Arnold Schwarzenegger's original performance. He was Conan.
I don't know a lot about Megan Fox. I hated Transformers. That's about all I have to say. So maybe there's some inner talent in there that's going to leap out when she puts on the chainmail bikini, and I don't know.
Shoot me now.
Every once in a while, you go to a superhero movie or a movie like this that you kind of think is going to be bad, and then it turns out to be good. I remember when I went to see the X-Men movie, I got tickets to an advanced screening because a friend of mine was an editor at Science Fiction Book Club. And we went in there, and I went in there with like no hope. Like I went in there like expecting to watch them just like piss all over my childhood.
And everybody was upset with Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. Everybody thought that that was going to be the worst thing, the worst casting ever.
I thought the whole thing was, you know, Halle Berry had me worried. Like, I just thought the whole thing was going to be another case of someone who doesn't understand comic books and doesn't understand superheroes trying to force these characters on the screen and rob each of them of all the things that made them cool and unique. And like, I was ready to hate that movie. And then I went in and it was awesome. Like the Bryan Singer knew what he was doing. And he respected the characters and he did an amazing job. That movie was great. And so ever since then, I've said to myself, like, you never know what you're going to get. So like if they have a good director and a good script, like, I don't know, maybe Megan Fox is, you know, maybe she'll be great with the fight choreographer. Like maybe she'll do something awesome. I don't know.
Or you could get Daredevil.
Yeah. Or Elektra. Although I refused to watch Elektra after I watched about 30 minutes of Daredevil. And then I got so angry that I just started fast forwarding. And then I don't even think I watched the end. I was just so mad.
I actually watched the director's cut R-rated edition of Daredevil, hoping.
What made it R-rated?
I have no idea.
I don't know. That movie was just that. You never know. Like when they go make a movie, like if the director really appreciates the core material or not. It's hit and miss every time. You know, you get. Because then Bryan Singer went on to make Superman, and Superman is not so good.
No, don't bring up creepy stalker Superman.
It's not even the creepy stalker. It's like, how does he lift up a whole island made of kryptonite when just being near kryptonite like is enough to take away all his powers and kill him? It doesn't make any sense.
It does if you realize that he's a Jedi and he used the Force.
Anyway, so my point is that like you never know what you're going to get. You have all the cast and all the director and all the money you want, and you still get a lousy movie. And then other times, movie comes out of nowhere and it's awesome. So
kick ass.
Well, that's like the Waterman's now been optioned for a film, has it not?
Yes.
And what are your hopes for that kind of? I mean, that how it will come off, and how involved are you in that project?
I'm not terribly involved. In general, when you get your book options, the people kind of option it, and then they mostly want you to step away.
Because they can make it better.
Well, here's the thing: books and movies are two different medium, and they are paced differently, they are cut differently, and they serve a different purpose. If you try and make a movie that follows a book too closely, you will get a crappy movie, especially if it's a big epic fantasy book that's a billion pages long. Like you can't just translate something directly to film. So there has to be a certain amount of artistic license in order to make a movie move, to make a movie come to life. Even the Lord of the Rings movies, which everyone kind of holds up as the best adaptation of a fantasy book to a movie, and for good reason. They're fantastic. Even there, Peter Jackson made a lot of changes, cut stuff out, moved stuff around to make the story flow better and be more cohesive and fit into, you know, 12 hours instead of 30.
Yeah, like cutting out all the majority of the stuff before the council at Elrond, which is kind of dull.
Yeah, like fuck Tom Bombadil. I don't care that they cut him. He was good. I didn't even like him in the book. To be honest.
Point of order. Point of order. Peter Jackson said that he did not cut Tom Bombadil. We just didn't see Tom Bombadil.
That sounds like a grand cop-out to me.
Yeah.
So I wanted to throw something out there as far as the movie, the book conversion to movie thing. Merle Lafferty was talking about this. She said that she's thinking that Hollywood is finally kind of getting on board and getting it and understanding that a novel, especially an epic fantasy novel, does not translate well to a two-hour film. But it does translate well to like a season of television. Or the cable season of television, like 13 episodes. Well, so, you know,
what is she holding up as an example of that? If she's pointing at Legend of the Seeker,
no, she's pointing.
That's questionable.
No, yeah. Legend of the Seeker sucked. Legend of the Seeker had nothing whatsoever to do with the books, which probably could have been a good thing.
In its case, it was a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, they could have done so much more. But
it
think
more like Hercules, like classic Sam Raimi type stuff, just. Go out there and slice things apart.
But it didn't even have the charm of Sam Raimi's stuff, you know? Sam Raimi had like there was a je ne sais quoi about that kind of made it fun and you didn't take it too seriously. I don't know. I only watched two episodes of Legend of the Seeker, but it did not seem to have that same fun.
No, the problem is that he was trying to revive weekly syndicated drama. He was trying to get back to the days when on any given weekend, you had on television, you know, Hercules, Xena, maybe you had Friday the 13th, the series, you had War of the Worlds was syndicated for a while, you had Babylon 5, you had Star Trek, Deep Space Nine, and Next Generation. Sure. You know, you had all these shows that were syndicated, and that has all gone away. And I don't think that particular model works anymore. But no, I think Murr is talking more along the lines of something like Game of Thrones.
Well, to be fair, we don't know how Game of Thrones is going to turn out. Look, I'm as excited about it as anybody. But, like, there's been so much... You know, like there's trailers everywhere and everybody's talking about how wonderful it is and how great it is and whatever. And I'm kind of sitting here going, all right, but it better be good because like you're getting me really worked up that it's going to be great. And if it's not, you know, like Rome, I'm going to be really deeply disappointed. But if it had just flown under the radar, there wouldn't have been so much like pressure on it.
Well, I think if it was going on the channel formerly known as Sci-Fi, we'd be in trouble. But it's going on HBO, and HBO has a pretty decent track record with their shows. I would argue that True Blood is better than the novels.
I haven't read the novels, although I did just finish watching all the seasons of True Blood, that show did kind of grow on me. You're right. Like all the like, yeah. There haven't been a lot of bad HBO shows. So like, certainly the odds are good for Game of Thrones. And like I said, I'm as psyched about it as anybody. But I do feel like they're raising everybody's expectations so high that it's going to be this masterpiece. And I don't know. That gives me anxiety.
some portion of it is going to fall flat on some portion of viewers.
Sure. And,
There's no way around that.
You're always going to have the ultimate fan who wants Tom Bombadil, and for whatever reason, Tom Bombadil is the beginning and ending of that series for them. And without Tom Bombadil, it sucks.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, I had forgotten about Tom Bombadil by the end of The Fellowship of the Ring. You know, when I watched that movie, I had completely forgotten that he wasn't in there. It didn't hurt my feelings at all.
All right, so back to the original point.
Whoa. There was an original point?
Sure.
That does not happen on this podcast.
Is that what we started out talking about and how it's going to translate?
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, I remember that now.
Wasn't that the original point?
Yeah.
So I accept that the movie is not going to be like my books. And I don't think that the movie can ruin my books. My books are, you know, permanent things like the writing inside them isn't going to change if they make a bad movie. But that said, I was very protective of those books when people started calling me up asking me if I wanted to option the series. You know, my guard was up. I didn't want somebody making a crappy movie out of my books. So when I met with Paul Anderson, I was very on guard and we sat down and we had lunch and we talked for 2-3 hours, I think, just about the series. And I really like, cause most of my dealings up until that point had been with his like assistants and the agent that we had in Hollywood, and I hadn't really spoken to him. So when we sat down and he started talking about the books, I was floored at how he had not only read them, he'd read them like really closely and shared them with his friends and had long conversations about them and had strong opinions about how the characters should look and how the demons should look. He's like, I picture this shot and I picture that shot, and here's how we put this together. And like, here's what I think your core, you know, meta story is, and that's what we would focus the movie on. And here's how we, and when he started having that conversation with me, I was so impressed that not only did he like my books for real, like it wasn't just Hollywood backspeak, like he really liked them, but he liked them for the right reasons, you know? And so when I got that sense, and when he started talking about some of the shots that he wanted to set up and how the demons were going to look, like all of my like fears about it being a crappy movie kind of went away. And I was like, if this guy puts his vision, you know, makes that vision, I felt very confident that they would do a fantastic job. And I know it's a good story because I wrote it. So I'm pretty psyched for the movie. And there's still they're about to start pitching it to studios. And at this point, it's just an option. There's no guarantee it's actually going to happen. But I'm really excited if it does. I think it's going to be good stuff.
Sounds great.
If it gets made, does that mean you get to do a guest spot on Castle?
Is that how that works?
Well, yeah. It seems like all the authors that get their books and stuff turned into TV shows and movies get invited to his poker game.
To be fair, I've never seen Castle. Should I watch Castle?
Oh, Pete.
Do I need to watch Castle?
Yes.
Okay.
It is highly entertaining.
Look, I'm down with Nathan Fillion. I was a Firefly guy, and Captain Hammer. I just that was just one show. I just didn't have time. I never watched it.
There are Firefly Easter eggs spread throughout Castle's entire episodes. I mean, wasn't there like a Halloween episode where he dressed up as Malcolm Reynolds?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right, his first season on DVD.
Probably, yeah.
Oh,
and two seasons are on DVD, actually.
And this is what cracks me up. He plays like a thriller author who gets embedded with the New York Police Department so he can create a new character.
Yeah, I remember reading like the blurb.
They paid somebody to write the book as Rick Castle. So there is actually the book that he was writing in the show. Someone went out and ghost wrote under the name of Rick Castle, and they actually released it.
Well, that's awesome. All right, that's good. I like it. I like it when people resoundingly recommend the show to me. I will happily watch that, and then I'll get your jokes about it.
So, what else we have, Jan?
I think that pretty much wraps up everything I got. Just asking about Daylight War and how that's going along, and what we could expect to see.
All right, well, Daylight War. There's still a lot of writing left to do for Daylight War. It's going to be a big book, at least as big as the Desert Spear, probably a little bit bigger. I'm gonna hold myself to the quintet for the series, meaning there will be 5 books that have like a complete story arc that wraps up the Arlen Jardier, Alicia, Brenna storylines in 5 books, so that like the series is not going to be a big open-ended thing. That doesn't mean I won't later write books set in the same world with different characters, maybe in a different place. I don't know. Sure. But like that will be a complete story arc. But because I've put that limitation on it, as the story kind of swells, like the books are going to get longer and longer in order to contain it all. But it's not, I'm determined to not let it spill over because I don't want, like I know how the series ends and I don't want to stretch it out too long because I want to have it finished and then be, you know, free to do other projects.
Does like cut material going to end up things like Brian's Gold, which I guess is releasing, what is it, this month?
Yeah, it's out. It came out in January.
Oh, okay.
It's almost sold out, actually. They only printed, I don't know, maybe 4,000 of them because it's a limited edition thing from Subterranean Press.
I love Subterranean. I think they're pretty awesome.
Oh, they're amazing.
Yeah, and the Brian's Gold book is gorgeous. Like the interior illustrations that Lauren did are amazing. The cover is great. Like the deluxe version is this like white leather. It's
nice,
beautiful, beautiful book. But yeah, the idea is that as I'm writing the series, I have so many different POV characters and so many like you know, second and third tier characters who have written full backstories for, who are actually really exciting. But if I diverge too much in the main books to tell these little side stories, it messes up the rhythm of each individual novel. So The Great Bazaar and Brian's Gold were two examples of like, well, I really wanted to tell this story and I think it's a good story as a standalone, but it would kind of trip up if I just stuck it in the middle of a book. So Subterranean was the perfect medium for that. And now we're also releasing those books as ebooks, so anybody can get them and read them if they want to. And it's a nice kind of way to expand the universe of the series, but you don't need to read those novellas in order to enjoy the novels, and you don't need to read the novels in order to enjoy those little novellas. So they're a good, like, this is a good way to test out if you want to read Peter Brett books, is read one of those little novellas and see what you think. Or if you're already someone who likes the series and you want to have a little extra time with your favorite characters, that's
oh yes, please.
And I have a few more. I have a few more of those novellas already set up. One of them is half written, and I have ideas for a few more. So those will keep coming as like ancillary things to the main books.
That's really cool that you can work it out like that. I mean, you got these massive books, and you know sometimes people don't want to commit to a series that isn't done yet. I especially have a lot of friends like that. And that even though I highly recommend your books, they're like, I'm not going to touch it till he's done, which, you know, that's 10 years, 15 years down the road.
Yeah, I understand the feelings that drive that attitude, but I don't entirely agree with that attitude, because I think that, you know, like if now's the time that you're reading fantasy and you have time for it and you're excited about it, like, I don't know. I read a lot of series that were not finished that I just read them as they came out. I used to do that with all the Terry Brooks books. I did it with Robert Jordan. You know, I'm still waiting for the end of Wheel of Time.
So am I.
So are all of us. But the thing is that even if Robert Jordan had died and that Wheel of Time series was never finished, I would argue that those, especially the first few books, were so fantastic and so life-changing for me and so inspiring for me that, like, kind of who cares if he finishes it or not. It's not going to change the fact that The Shadow Rising like changed my life and taught me things about writing that I didn't understand before and took me on an amazing adventure that I've read 10 times.
I think it's just a frustration.
Game of Thrones. Like Game of Thrones was a genre changing book. It influenced tons of authors and it was something groundbreaking and amazing. And it is no less groundbreaking and amazing, even if George R. R. Martin never finishes the series.
But it's a frustration for the fan.
Books. What?
But it's a frustration for the fans, though.
Sure.
And that
frustrations. You know?
Well, yeah, but I mean, when it comes to something like Wheel of Time, which I love, my circle of friends doesn't read it. And you know, I've had a hard time like finding people to talk to about it, just you know, here locally. I'm sure I could if I looked a little bit harder, but I just mean among my friends, you know, my sphere. And one of the things is, you know, oh my God, that's the series that he promised would be done in 7, and they're on like 14 now. And I think that you know, if you set an expectation, and then you go way over it, that can kill your momentum a little bit with your fans. And you point to the two that are the biggest you know, the biggest complaints among fantasy fans is the Wheel of Time and, you know, the Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah, and that's my point. I agree with you that stretching things out beyond what they were originally intended can throw off and disappoint some fans. And I think it, particularly in the case of the Wheel of Time, it did dilute the story and make it less compelling and less interesting. And I think Brandon Sanderson is doing a wonderful job of tying up the thousands of loose ends that he is.
And I don't envy him in the least.
Yeah.
He has the Tom Bombadil problem.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a champion for powering through it. And the books that he's produced have been very good.
My point remains, though, that
regardless of your frustration overall, like Shadow Rising, which is book four of the Wheel of Time, is one of the best books I've ever read in my life. And whether he finishes the series or not, that won't change. There's a complete story arc in that book. You can pick it up without having read any of the others and read it. And there's closure at the end. And it's an awesome, awesome book. And the same thing with Game of Thrones.
What's the plot line of Shadow Rising? I'm trying to remember. Is that the one where
Perrin goes back to the Two Rivers because the Trollocs are attacking?
Yes, yes.
And has to work out all of his personal problems in the meantime. And at the same time, Rand is in Ruidian. Right. Rand is in Ruidian, like becoming one with the Aiel people.
He and Matt.
And Egwene.
Yes.
Yeah, it's an awesome book. And same thing with Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones changed how I write forever. It changed how I read. It changed what I was able to expect from books and taught me that I had to write the right to demand a higher level of quality than some of the crap that I've been reading. So you can be frustrated that the series aren't finished, but I think it would be a very sad thing if somebody said, you know what, I'm never going to read those books because the series isn't finished, because they're missing out on something great. And I'm not trying to say anything about my own work in that. I'm saying it about Rob Jordan and George R. R. Martin, because I'm waiting for those books too. And I understand the frustration of everyone else who's waiting for them, because I'm frustrated too. I want to read the next book, but I also kind of appreciate the writer's side of it. Think that it does a disservice to the quality of them to say, like, oh, well, if it's not done, I'm just going to draw a line in the sand and say that's a reason not to read it.
You're still going to have, and I'm sorry, there's going to be the person, and I think Sanderson, number one, I don't envy him at all. Number two, he's doing a great job. Kudos to him for, you know, having the balls to take on this project. He said he's going to finish it, and one of the things that he said from the beginning is that he has notes from Mr. Jordan that specifically say, do not solve all the mysteries. Do not tie up all the loose ends. Leave some dangling. And he wanted to do that on purpose. He said there are some mysteries that he just wanted to keep as mysteries. And so you're going to have someone out there who is going to lose their freaking mind if they don't learn who killed Asmodian.
Yeah, but you know what? You can't make everybody happy.
I know.
No matter what you do, you can't make everybody happy. Frankly, I don't care who killed Asmodian. I'm as big a Wheel of Time fan as there is. And you know what? That guy got killed in book 5, and we're on book like 12 now. And I didn't even really care that much then who killed him. It's like, yeah, he recognized his killer before it happened, and they don't tell you who it is. And like, but that was 4,000 pages ago. I don't care who killed Asmodian. When it's revealed, I'm sure, like, I'll be like, oh, whatever. Oh, great, Tom did it. You know, like I don't care. So, when you're writing a big series, sometimes little things like that come up that one person or another will obsess over, and that's fine. But you can't write what your fans expect. You have to write what the story is, you know, like the writer has a story in their head that they want to tell. And if they start changing that story based on what the fans want, I think that's a recipe for disaster, because it's impossible to please everybody.
What did you think of Varen's Secret?
I was real that I don't want to give any spoilers.
I know, I don't either.
It really threw me for a loop when that
happened. Yeah, didn't it? I didn't expect that.
Yeah, I did not see that coming. No. And at first I got mad. And then as I read on, I was like, oh, you know what? Actually, this is kind of cool. But yeah, Varin was one of my favorite characters in those early books.
She's a crafty old bird.
Yeah, I like her a lot. And so I don't know if that was Brandon's thing or if it was
I think it was
Jordan's
planned.
Notes directly.
I think it was planned from the beginning.
Kudos to whoever did that because it was well played.
Yep. So, John, do you have any other questions before I put out the Facebook question?
Oh, well, yeah, that was the only one left. That's what I was going to go with, was just to
go for
put
it.
That out.
Go for it. Well, this is from Ian Crowfeather on Facebook.
And Ian wants to ask you, is a creative writing class worth it? Is it something that should be done?
Is it good or a bad thing?
Yeah, is it a good or a bad thing?
It depends on the class. It depends on the teacher. I've had creative writing classes that were worthless, and I've had creative writing classes that changed my life. The Warded Man was originally started as a project that I did in a creative writing class. I was working on a different book called Heart's Guard. And I took this continuing education class in fantasy writing at NYU just to kind of give myself incentive to work, you know? So I go there and the teacher said, we're not going to look at anything that you've already written. The only thing we're going to discuss in this class is stuff that you write in this class. And one of our assignments was to write the first chapter to a fantasy novel. And I knocked it out in one night, the night before class. And it was this little fairy tale about this boy named Arlen who had never gone more than half a day's walk from his home because at night the demons come out and he had to have enough time to get home and get behind the magical protection before the demons come out. And so he always had this wanderlust that he could never satisfy and how it was a building anxiety in him. And I thought that was kind of like a good, all right, there's an adventure waiting to happen there intro. And I wrote it for that class, and that little story became the core crux that the whole demon cycle was built around. So in my case, yeah, creative writing class was great and helped me a lot.
I think Jim Butcher would also be a fan of creative writing classes. His Stormfront was written in a creative writing class.
So yeah, but you know, you get out of a class what you put into it. And so you can't just go and expect the class to do the work for you. Like, writing is hard. It's hard work. It requires a lot of practice. And if you go and you put your all into that class, then for some people, the class can be a good focus to help them work. And for other people who are more inclined to do stuff on their own, a class can be frustrating and not helpful. So it depends on the kind of person you are and the kind of writer you are. But I'm certainly not going to say anything bad about them because maybe the man I am today.
The only thing I'll say bad about him is, God, teachers bug me. God, teachers.
Hey, Esper. Tread lightly, buddy. Gosh. If you didn't know, in my day job, I'm a school teacher. So, middle school teacher, no less. So, Hester, I will fly out there and beat the crap out of you.
I just got a letter yesterday from a friend of mine from high school who's now a creative writing teacher at the senior level in high school. And she wrote to me and said that she had a signed copy of my book in her classroom that I had sent her when the book first came out. And one of her students who never, ever, ever reads, started flipping through it and asked her if he could borrow it. And she said no, because it was an autographed copy and she didn't want people taking it out of the classroom. So he started sneaking in on his lunch hour to read it. And so here's a kid who doesn't normally read. And now, because my book was lying in the right place at the right time, now he's reading. And nice. That's the most awesome thing I ever heard.
That is.
Yeah. I find that's really true of fantasies, especially. Like, I got a kid who absolutely hated to read. I handed him Brian Jakes, and the kid devoured him. And he was reading third grade level, and then he reads Brian Jakes, and now he can't get enough. And even ended up deciding to become an English teacher as a result.
I read the Lord of the Rings because my teacher had it in the classroom and said, because I was bored all the time in class, she said, here, read this. And I was totally hooked. Totally hooked. Couldn't put it
down. Yeah, I mean, every fan of reading has a story like that. And, you know, it started in a different place for all of us, but that almost everyone can be like, oh, yeah, I remember my first book that I read because I wanted to and not because I had to. And it's like the thought that I could be that for somebody is like there's nothing better than that. You know, there's nothing cooler than that.
All right. Well, any follow up thoughts there, John?
No, I think that's an excellent place to wrap it up. Other than wondering when we're going to see you have a tattooed ward on you.
Very soon. I have the design done. I've just been very lazy about going to the tattoo parlor. So like I've just been so busy doing 100 other things that like I haven't gotten around to it, but I'm definitely doing it. I got a tattoo about from that other book that I was talking about, Heart's Guard. Back when I was a struggling writer, I kind of got the tattoo and put it on my forearm to like force me to remember to like keep pursuing writing as a career. And so I really want to get a matching tattoo from the books that actually sold, like on the other arm to bring balance to the force.
So, tell the listeners where to find your stuff. What's your website?
www.petervbrett.com is my website. There's a lot of great stuff on there. There's deleted scenes, there's a forum, there's my blog. You can all check that out. I'm also on Twitter.
I've never seen you on Twitter. You're on Twitter? They're going to kill me, folks, because I guess I'm in a mood tonight. I'm teasing
you. Well, yeah, you were Twittering about me all day. Like, apparently I'm going to be in a cage match with Brent Weeks.
I was doing the announcer voice for that, yes.
I would pay to see that.
There have to be weapons involved, because that's not a fair fight, because Brent's got, like, least 60 pounds on me.
But he's so sweet and cuddly.
Yeah.
You're like lean, you know, and muscled and all this. And of course you fought with Kendo with the
sword.
That's
why I'm saying I want weapons. Oh, like if you give both of us swords, I have no fear. I'll step right into that match. But if it's bare hands, yeah, he's a sweet guy, but as Pat Roth says, the wise man fears the anger of a gentle man. You don't want to see Brent when he gets the bloodlust on him.
And see, And I heard the story. I heard, you know, when he came here and he was at Tattered Cover, he did the little story about his brother, and you know them.
Oh, that's so hilarious! Yeah, go ahead.
Back and forth and fighting all that kind of stuff. So you know, I could see him going a little crazy in that cage match.
This is what I'm saying. Like, give me a sword and I'll take the guy on. But I'm not bare knuckling it with Brent Weeks.
Anyway, you are on Twitter. What is it? Is it PV Brett?
PV Brett.
Yes. Are you on Facebook?
Yes. I always forget if my Facebook is PV Brett as well, or if it's Peter V Brett. But yeah, I'm on it.
What about MySpace? You still doing MySpace?
I have a MySpace account. To be honest, I haven't checked it in like 6 months.
Yeah, LinkedIn? Are you on LinkedIn? Do you have a Google Buzz? What about Foursquare?
See, like, I'm on LinkedIn. I the whole time I'm like, why am I on LinkedIn? Like, what's the point of this? I've never understood. I mean, so like, since I left my desk job, like, I've kind of felt I didn't really understand the point of
being on LinkedIn,
but I'm on there. And
and are you doing any conventions coming up? Any book signings, anything like that?
I have a convention in France in May, and then I'll be at World Fantasy again. Which is in San Diego this year. I might go to Worldcon in Reno. I haven't decided yet.
Yeah, neither have I.
I promised myself that this year was going to be like lighter on conventions, because last year I think I stretched myself to my introvert limit. You know, like I just went to too many conventions, and by the end of the year I was totally burnt out on it. So I swore that like this year I would tone it back a little bit. But I'm already, you know, like I did Confusion in Detroit like 2 weeks ago, and now I've got another one coming up, and I'm sure a bunch more will pop up and I'll end up going to them.
What kind of carrot do I need to hang in front of you to get you to come down to Florida? Because no authors like to come to us.
That's because it's too humid down there.
No, it's warm and there's a beach.
It's humid.
There's a lot of beach.
I've been to Florida. I like it. I haven't been to Florida in a very long time, but I have family down there. Like, I'm not totally opposed to it. Is there a big Florida convention I should be considering going to?
I wouldn't say that there's a huge one. There's several. I mean, Florida, it's a big state. So, but Orlando is nice and central. And of course, you've got a huge sci-fi fantasy presence here because of NASA being located here.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's surprising because Brent Weeks came down and he met with me.
Brent Weeks went to dinner with you and he turned me down. Thanks for reminding me again.
I always have to rib him about that one. Anyway, but yeah, he came and had and all he did was a reading and a signing at a Barnes & Noble in Orlando and had a massive turnout.
He did a contest
to promote Black Prism?
Yeah.
That's so when the Daylight War comes out, they're going to send me on a tour like that.
So
the new book.
Here's what Brent did though. What he said was, you know, I can't go everywhere. So he did some sort of contest or you know, tell me which cities I should go to or something like that.
Orbit ran it. His publisher ran it.
Yeah. And so that's why, you know, he came here to Denver. He went to Florida. He, you know, he hit several different cities so that, just like you, he didn't want to be heavy on conventions because he owed another book. But he wanted to go out and support, you know, Black Prism. So that's why he did that. And I think that worked really well for him. My gosh.
And Sanderson was the week before at the same Barnes & Noble. Again, same massive amount of turnout.
I don't know if that's making any more time for their books, because I know both of those guys and they both had kind of grueling travel schedules while they were on those little tours.
So
I don't know about them, but I mean, Brandon Sanderson, I'm sure, can write in his sleep, but he plays
magic in his sleep. he's whenever he goes to sleep, he's busy tapping trees and plains and swamps, so on and so forth. So we better call this done, or else John's never going to get to go to sleep.
Right.
So
sleep. Who needs sleep?
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Thank you for coming on. We appreciate it. And there you have it, our interview with Peter V. Brett, author of The Warded Man and the Desert Spear. I'd like to thank John Ottinger again for helming that for the most part. I know I interrupted him, but, you know, I'm me. It's going to happen. I think our interviewers are used to that by now. I would like to point out that no Muppets were harmed in the recording of this podcast. So there. If you have any thoughts, any suggestions, any kind of comments whatsoever about this podcast, please feel free to call our voicemail line. That's 720-277-9082. Or if you go to sfsignal.com, you can click on the little flash widget from Google on the post, and Google will actually call you and save you a long-distance phone call. Again, I want to thank everyone for listening. If you enjoy this podcast, please tell a friend or two, or go to iTunes, give us a couple stars, maybe write us a review, help us build listeners. Next week, we will have another panel and another interview. Hope you guys will come back for that. Until then, have a great week. Bye.